Welcome to Kindled Podcast. I'm your host, Haley Williams, and this is the show where we talk about work, motherhood, and the grace we need for both. We are making and being made. Come join us. Hey, friends. Welcome back to Kindled. This is episode 96, and I'm your host, Haley Williams. Today, I'm going to be chatting with Andi Kolber. Andi is a licensed therapist, and she offers insight into a commonly overlooked form of trauma that affects the average individual. What she defines as little t traumas, like moving cities, unresolved shame, losing a friendship, all of these things can add up and leave our body experiencing symptoms similar to PTSD. Now, this is an area that I know literally nothing about, and so it was really interesting to chat with Andi about what she has learned through her research as a licensed therapist and from working with her clients. And it was just appealing to me to even consider that there might be another approach from trying harder, because we all know how tempting and easy it is to kind of just should ourselves into more effort and more intensity. And maybe sometimes that is not the right approach. So if you're like me, and that is generally the route that you take to move through difficult situations, trying harder and harder with whatever tools you have, maybe you, like me, need to also hear that it's okay to equip yourself, mind, body, and soul, to better live into the truth of who God made you to be. And it's okay to offer yourself kindness because God is kind to you. So I am not going to take any more of Andi's thunder here. I'm going to let her do the talking. Here's my chat with Andi Kolber. All right. So Andi, welcome to Kindled. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
So before we get into the topic of discussion today, I would love for you to introduce yourself to listeners and just tell us about yourself and your family.
Yeah, so I am a therapist, a licensed therapist in Castle Rock, Colorado, and I've been practicing for, gosh, probably over 12 years, if I'm remembering correctly. And yeah, I've been married for about 12 years. I have two kiddos, and my work is really centered. I have a private practice here in Castle Rock, and my work is really centered around a very holistic lens. I am a Christian, but I really do a lot around helping people integrate their mind, body, spirit, and use that to address the different pains that might be coming up for them.
It's really interesting. You're going to get into that more. But before we do, what does your work look like just as a mom every day? Are you working full time? You have kids at home in preschool? What does that look like?
Yeah, I work somewhat part time. It's kind of muddy right now because I'm also an author. And so a lot of the work that I do in the realm of being an author is sort of in the margins of life. So, you know, it could be like at night, or it could be when my son naps. It could be, I mean, there's just a lot of little things that come up. But my main career is as a mental health therapist. And right now in this stage of life, because I have a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old, I actually do just one full private practice day a week. And I did that. I used to work full time, and that was great for the season. But when my daughter was born, I, particularly in the mental health field and as a survivor, I'm a survivor of childhood trauma. I found that the emotional bandwidth that I needed to be present for both my kids and my clients, it was costing me more than I had to give, is the best way for me to say it.
Yeah.
So I, at different times, have adjusted. You know, at times I've added more days to my private practice. But right now, as I have a fairly young son and also juggling the book and author gig, yeah, this feels about right. Like it feels, I mean, between all the things, I probably still spend about 25 to 30 mm-hmm. hours a week, but it's not necessarily all in my office.
Yeah, I know. I'm around the same amount, and I have an in-home office and work from home totally, but it's amazing when you count it up, like I'm still actually working like a decent amount. It's just kind of in the margins. So it's pretty incredible how we can make that work if we need to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a huge blessing. So where are you seeing God's grace in your life right now?
Yeah, I love that question. So I'm in my faith, one of the ways that I've really, things have almost become more simple in the sense that I really look for God in the present, like in the moment, and just really experiencing this idea of God is already with us, you know, Emmanuel, God with us. And so for me, what that's really looked like, especially in the last couple years, is inviting myself and having compassion for myself, like when I'm anxious or when I'm having a hard time, to sort of get settled and notice the ways that God is already here. And so I think that that is probably the number one thing, is that if I can have eyes to see that, like, I don't have to hustle for God's presence, that I don't have to search or try or even make myself look a certain way, mm-hmm. but just really recognizing that God is already here.
Yeah, that's good. I like that answer. So you mentioned childhood trauma. Can you kind of tell me, as much as you're wanting to or willing to, about your story and how that kind of led you to where you are today, doing the work you're doing, writing this book, all of that?
Yeah.
I'm sure that could probably be our entire episode, but if you want to try and encapsulate that, however it makes sense. Sure.
Yeah. So the way that I sort of talk about this, I have four other siblings. And so I'm always a little bit, tend to be really gentle with how I tell my story, because there's so many people who are involved that there are parts that are not simply mine to tell.
Sure.
But what I do talk about is that I grew up in a home that there was just a ton of chaos and dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And what that looked like in particular is that my dad was pretty significantly verbally and emotionally abusive to us. And that really affected all of us. And it affected just the work that I do. We'll talk about this more, but what we've come to understand is that the way that our caregivers are with us significantly shapes our brains. It affects our nervous systems. And ultimately, it really creates a template for how we experience life. So in those experiences, my mom also, she ended up becoming an alcoholic, and the dynamics of our family was just, it was pretty toxic at times. Some of the language I use at times is I became parentified, meaning I took on responsibilities that were extremely inappropriate for my age. I felt responsible for the safety and wellness of my parents. There was just, I learned to live outside of what is called our window of tolerance. And what I mean by that is simply that all of us have a level of sort of emotional arousal that we can handle before our body sends us either into fight or flight, or potentially even freeze, which is like a form of like dissociation when you're sort of there but not there. So I sort of learned to spend a lot of my life in what I call, I learned to white knuckle it. So I was, on the outside, people just thought I was like maybe a really hard worker. I pushed myself so hard because that is the way that I sort of learned to be safe. I learned that if I sort of looked good on the outside, if I kept my dad happy, if everybody was happy with me, if I got good grades and I did all these things, it felt like a certain level of safety. And so all that to say, you know, this really has been this journey of my life to untangle so much of like what is truly me and my personality versus what is based in trauma, and what does God think about these experiences that I've had, and what is God's posture to me in pain. So I ultimately, after undergrad, I went to a Denver Seminary and I got my degree in counseling. And that was such a really important time because I got to really wrestle with my faith while I was learning about psychology and like, how do these things intersect? And it's really probably been the journey of really at least a decade of doing a lot of my own personal work and therapy, finding safe people, including my husband, and allowing my nervous system to unwind the trauma and allowing and really re-experiencing God as safe. Because I've been a Christian my whole life, but for much of my life, I experienced God as quite scary, really. Like I wanted to please God, but I felt afraid ultimately? Like, what about when I'm not good enough?
Yeah.
So this book really is this work of my heart to, it's called Try Softer. And it's really about this idea that white knuckling it, these times when we go outside of our window of tolerance, there's so many issues with it. But one of them is that we become not ourselves in the sense that our whole brain is no longer integrated. We're really living from sort of a trauma response.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are not, we can't connect with people. We can't learn. We can't be creative. It's difficult to be curious. And it's just really hard on our bodies. It just keeps us really stuck in our pain. And so, yeah, I just am super passionate about helping people understand that we don't have to keep living like this.
Man, yeah. As you were talking, well, first off, you said you have four siblings. Are you the oldest?
I'm not.
Okay.
I'm the fourth of five.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of feels random sometimes. But in the way of the birth order, my older siblings went to college. And just when the way that things were in our home, I sort of took on some parts of what it felt like to be an oldest child.
Yeah. That's interesting. As just as you were talking, I was like, you've got to be the oldest because I'm the oldest of five. And a lot of what you described sounds a lot like me. So I was just like, oh man, this is yikes. This is interesting. But it's funny because my fourth sister, the number four, my parents have always called the second firstborn. And I think for similar reasons, kind of because the three oldest ones like were out of the house. And then she and my youngest sister were still at home, and like there almost is like a reset in a sense of like the responsibilities and like expectations because your other siblings are gone and it just looks different in that, you know, in that season for them. So that's interesting. Birth order is always very interesting to me.
It really is. And I think like so many things in our bodies, it's like so much of it is really about perception versus what actually was. So like what you're saying, you know, with your sister who's the fourth, it's like, it's similar to me. Like I experienced things in my family as someone who needed to take responsibility.
Yeah.
Regardless of my birth order.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. That's really interesting. So you also said something that I want to kind of press into a little bit, the idea of what is us versus what is based in trauma, because I bet a lot of people who were listening to you describe your experience and growing up, we're probably like, that sounds a lot like my experience or something similar happened to me. Like we had a lot of chaos or we had a lot of, you know, upheaval or my parents got divorced or there was just some sort of a situation. Mm-hmm. Most people, you know, have some sort of, you call it little T trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Which maybe that's a good place to start talking about, you know, what does that mean? And this idea of trauma, because I think that's a term that we're hearing a lot lately. You know, we're hearing that. I don't know why it just suddenly seems like it's, maybe there's just more research being done on it. I'm hearing it all over the place, but a lot of times we disassociate from that because we're like, well, I don't have trauma. Like I don't have some big, you know, dark secret that I've been keeping from people, or I don't have some terrible thing that happened. But your kind of perspective on this is a little bit different that, you know, we all actually experience trauma in some way, shape or form. Can you kind of unpack that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I think where I would start is to say that I define trauma really broadly from in the sense of trauma is anything that overwhelms our nervous system and our ability to cope. And so what that means is, like I described earlier with our window of tolerance, probably one of the most basic ways to think of that is when you experience something that goes outside of your window of tolerance and you don't have the support or resources to allow that to basically process through your body. Meaning this is like an actual full body experience.
Mm-hmm.
You might think of it like, let's say you were in the street and you were about to get hit by a car. Your body would automatically send, you know, adrenaline to like basically help you move out of the way, whether or not without a conscious thought at all to get out of the way of that car. But let's just say like somehow you did get hit. The difference between those two situations is like if you almost got hit, but you moved, in a sense, that's you actually processing the like what could become a trauma, because your response was able to come to get you to safety and allow you to sort of like come back down into your window of tolerance. So a trauma response is not necessarily bad. Like, we actually need it. It's actually a gift. Like, I actually really believe that it's a gift from God that our bodies are made to heal. Mm-hmm. But let's say in the other way, you end up getting hit, and then, you know, maybe, you know, you're strapped down in a, you know, an ambulance, and you're not allowed to move. And just, there's elements to that where it gets what I call stuck. So the difference between those is that your body never fully gets to maybe process the way that it like activated into the fight or flight, but then it like, then you got experience something that was so overwhelming that your body just didn't know what to do with it. That's what makes it trauma. So with this idea, it's like, that's, it might sound really intense, and maybe a lot of people haven't had that experience, but let's think about, you know, a kiddo who's maybe six years old, and they come home and they've had these really big feelings, and their parents shame them because they had a terrible day at kindergarten. And the thing that their child that like internalizes is like, I'm bad and I'm alone, and it's not okay for me to feel these feelings. Hmm. Even though that seems really different, at a younger age, it doesn't take very much to overwhelm a nervous system. Hmm, so like, yeah. Let's just say that happens repeatedly, chronically, over and over again. By the time that same kiddo is 21 and they are at college and someone rejects them, that the intensity of that experience might be like the compilation of all those times that they felt rejected and they never learned how to feel the feelings they were experiencing. So like that would be a example of how little T trauma accumulates. And it's like in like one instance of little T trauma probably isn't going to affect your overall functioning. You know, one time of your parents not being emotionally available to you or saying something unhelpful isn't going to necessarily scar you for life. But when you experience that chronically and repetitively, that actually may really affect who you are in the present.
Interesting. Yeah, I've never heard it described that way, honestly. I don't know if I've ever heard an actual definition of trauma.
Yeah, and I mean, And it's important for us to probably put this next to the, you know, like the DSM definition of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm. And what's really, DSM?
So the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and it's like the fifth edition. And that's what like you use to give like clinical diagnosis of like, for example, PTSD. And so I think it is important to say trauma happens in a range.
So it's a spectrum.
It's a spectrum. And so if you've experienced things like that has been a threat to your life, or to observing someone who's been threatened, or if you've experienced sexual violence or a natural disaster, if you begin to experience symptoms from that, you are like almost certainly going to be diagnosed with PTSD. But here's what's really significant. When people have chronic unaddressed little t trauma, it can act on our bodies in similar ways to PTSD. So for me, as a person who grew up in the home that I did, I have had symptoms in my life that were very similar to someone who's maybe experienced a single event issue where they develop PTSD.
Okay.
So I think this is important for folks to begin to understand, because my hope is that it will help us not be so shaming to ourselves when things are hard, right? Because we begin to understand, oh, like my body is reacting to something, and that might be what that response is really about.
Wow. There's so much there. My mind's just like racing with all of the potential times in my life that that's either been the case with me, or thinking about my own daughter, like where are the times in her life that that might have already happened? And I could, you know, see pattern forming, or, you know what I mean? Like, cause as parents, we're not perfect. We mess up all the time. I'm emotionally unavailable all the time, you know, and just, you know, when I'm like, okay, not right now, I'm too busy, or I can't deal with this, or this is, or actually the weirder, or maybe more crazy thing is like when her emotional excess causes me to have like an emotional response, because like, and I talked about this in a recent episode about feelings with kids, and uncovered kind of like that when she is in pain or upset or gets hurt or really like kind of extreme emotion, it sort of triggers me into like, I can't fix this. I can't help you. I'm no longer in control. And it like makes me angry. So it's almost like that. It's just like this double, oh man, there's just like so many layers there that gotta like kind of work through and uncover what is happening, you know? And like you said, what is us versus what is based in the trauma? And I would imagine that takes a lot of work for someone to actually get to an understanding of that.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would want to say, because you're probably, even for your listeners, are, you know, folks might be feeling some feelings about what I'm saying. So the thing I want to just encourage folks is to understand that there is no perfect parent. And that really the goal, even from research that we're seeing, is this idea of what's called a good enough parent. Mm-hmm. And a good enough parent is when we are basically doing what we can to repair when we've really misattuned or hurt our kiddos.
Yeah.
And so it's less about, and even then we're not going to do it perfectly.
Yeah.
But repair is a huge idea, a concept within something called attachment. And attachment is really the basis for like the way that we sort of co-regulate with our kids. So what you're talking about a lot is regulation, learning to emotionally regulate. And that's a huge element of staying in our window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. And so when we
it's very hard in the toddler years.
Oh, I get it.
Regulation.
Oh man, I have a 2.5-year-old. I feel you so much. But I think, you know, that element of first remembering, like you don't have to be perfect. And then the second thing is this is why it's so important for us as parents to be doing our work. I mean, like it's important for people anyways, right? But as parents, the more that we can actually have compassion with ourselves and our own wounds, we actually create space in ourselves to have compassion for our kiddos as they're struggling. Yeah. And, you know, one of my favorite, it's like so short and simple, but I think it goes a long way, is this idea of connect and correct. Connect, then correct, actually. Or as I think Daniel Siegel, who's like a big person in this particular field, he says connect and redirect. And what that means is that connection first helps our kiddos stay in their window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when they're having a tantrum, they're not in their window of tolerance either, which means they literally cannot learn.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, when you're trying to talk to them and reason them through and they're like crying loudly, you know, you're like, I don't think you can even hear me. But it feels like we're grasping so tightly to like take back control of the situation, you know?
Absolutely. And I think this is where even a really basic understanding of our neuroscience matters. Because if we can understand when we're in that place, we as adults can't learn or be creative or empathetic, and kiddos can't learn. So often the first priority is actually to calm ourselves down. Mm-hmm. You know, like if our kids are having a hard time, if we can stay connected to ourselves and recognize like the priority is staying connected and calm to ourselves, we can then, even if it takes 10 minutes, like even if you have to say, wow, mom is really feeling overwhelmed right now. I'm going to go over here for a minute, you know, and I'm going to do, you know, there's lots of different things that you can do in that moment, but then come back and to help them calm down too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's helpful. Really hard to do, but, but a good thing to remember. And then like too, like you said, when we don't do that perfectly, which is going to be a lot of the time, to humble ourselves and ask for forgiveness, and that then model that to our kids too, because that's equally important, you know, for them to learn, because they're going to mess up. So it's like, what, and like you said, that is part of the repair, you know, like that's, that is a big piece of it, is like, hey, I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have snapped at you. I did this to my daughter yesterday on the way to the school, or the way to preschool. And I'm just like, So I was like, Isla, take your stupid cat. And I don't ever say stupid to her. I don't ever say she's stupid or anything that she owns is stupid. And so as soon as I got in the car, I was like, I'm sorry I said that your cat was stupid. It's not stupid. And she was like, it's okay. It's not even real. And I was like, that doesn't matter. I should never say that. I apologize. That was wrong. Mommy sins too. I need God's help. And she was like, yeah, I sin too. Like when I steal. And I was like when you steal, I was like, you don't steal. What do you mean? Well, I steal Juju's Shopkins and you've caught me. And I'm like, oh yeah, that yes, you have. And I'm glad you're finally admitting that you did take your sister's things. So, but it was just, you know, it's hard. Like, you know, when you say things like that, you're like, I would never want her to think that I think she's stupid or her things are stupid or that her mistake, like it was just an honest mistake. It was an accident. It wasn't like she was trying to make my life harder, but you know, we do that. And so it is so important to kind of learn those concepts and then actually humble ourselves, which we need God's help to do, and apologize.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is where there's just so many beautiful intersections with psychology and faith, is that, you know, is that God is our good parent. And that God actually can be such a resource to us when we're feeling condemnation and shame, like, oh, I'm so bad. I'm not good enough. Because it's like if we can connect to God as so loving towards us, as so gracious to us, we can be compassionate to ourselves, which allows us then to be compassionate to our kids. And there's just this really cool, like from a neuropsychological element, it's amazing. And also from a faith element. And really this is how kids, this is like, we, you know, we're so wanting to create kiddos in a generation that are humble and self-aware and connected to God and others and themselves. And it's like, this is the work. Like, doing this, allowing kids to see us being humble and having self-awareness is literally the way that they learn. Like, you know, that idea, it's like, what is the saying? It's caught, not taught.
More is caught than taught. Yep.
Yep. That is this.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's so true.
That's exactly what this is.
Yeah. If it doesn't feel hard, you might not be doing it right. You know?
You know, I often say, that's such a good point. Like, I say that good parenting is, I mean, first of all, I always say parenting is the hardest thing I've ever done.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And I think that parents who are leaning in to their own story, to their own wounds, it's the hardest thing that you'll do to do that. And so just because it's hard doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It probably means you're doing it exactly right.
Right. Yeah. So tell me about this idea. It's the title of your book, Try Softer. Tell me about this concept, because this is pretty like counter to our intuitive, like, idea of like, try harder, try harder, try harder. If I only could just do more. And that's my personality coming out, speaking, that I'm kind of this achiever oriented to do and check things off the list and work really hard and prove myself. All of those things are very familiar and feel kind of virtuous to me. Mm-hmm. So this idea of trying softer is like, wait, what does that mean? Do I still get things done? What is it? What does it actually look like?
Yeah. 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 So Try Softer is this idea that's evolved for me over this decade, but I use it synonymously. And I talk about this obviously a ton in the book, but really with learning to pay compassionate attention to ourselves. And so what I mean by that is we begin to get curious and listen to what is actually going on and what we actually need in a way to stay in that window of tolerance. So kind of bring it in that physiological element to recognize at any given moment, the way we try softer might look different. So it's like, for me, sometimes, like with my kiddos, sometimes trying softer is recognizing that I'm kind of exhausted. And taking my kids out is actually probably not a great idea. So trying softer is a way that I, in that situation, might be saying, I need to choose this differently. Like, we're actually, even though like they both need baths and we're like need to go out and get this thing right now, the healthiest choice so I can stay connected to myself and my kids is like to go outside and blow bubbles. Because in this moment, like if I were to make the choice to go do this other thing, it would mean I'm going to blow up at them. I can't stay in my window of tolerance well. And therefore, I need to figure out a different choice. And so really and that's just one example, but it's about learning to stay in our own, like, not so that we're completely self-focused, but that we love our neighbor as ourself, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're loving our neighbor as ourself and we're not paying attention to ourself, it means that what are we giving our neighbor? Like, it means
less than that.
Right. Like, we're like, hey, I minimize my pain and don't listen to my experience and tell myself I'm stupid. I'm going to go love my neighbor that way. And yeah. It's like, oh, that's maybe not what God wanted for us. You know, like, it's like, if I can be compassionate and say, wow, Andi, you're finishing a really tough week. This is going on. What is it that you need to stay sane in a way to make it through this next season? And so, or moment or 5 minutes. And so the book is really about, the first half is all about trauma and not just trauma, but like our bodies and how we sometimes disconnect from ourselves so we can basically white knuckle it. We have a culture of white knucklers. You know, maybe not everybody has had the same childhood that I did, but I would say that we are in a time, in a culture, even a church culture, in which we're pretty much trained to ignore the messages and the information of our body. And what we know from science, from neuroscience, from research, from trauma research, is that when we ignore our bodies, this is sort of the breeding ground for depression and anxiety and disconnection and addiction. And so so it's not pushing harder that will help us through those things. It's actually being more gentle and saying, maybe the reason why I feel like I need to get another 100 likes on this social media post is because I'm feeling insecure. So maybe I actually need to get curious with that and connect with the things that help me know that my value is not in what I do.
Wow. I think you just hit that so straight on. I mean, so dead on with, as you were talking about, even in the church that has happened. I don't know why that is. That might be a question bigger than we can answer, but how do you see that? And, you know, how do you see that playing out, and what do you make of that? And maybe I can ask you, maybe you have thought about, why are we so afraid of connecting with, like, and I don't like how this sounds, like connecting with myself. That sounds very like frou-frou. And I don't know. It sounds like, I don't know what that means. Do you know what I mean? But when you were saying just how like that is the breeding ground for addiction and anxiety and depression. And we see all of those things increasing in even younger generations than you and I, like in the next generation, Z or whatever they are, and like alpha or the I generation, which is our kids. We see that. Like I read a study the other day that was like 9 out of 10 kids are like on this, somehow would be categorized as having anxiety. And I don't know what that is based on or how they're measuring that, but just that it's rising, it's on the rise. That's concerning. It's like, why? Like, what happened? What are we doing wrong? What are we missing?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it is for sure a big topic, but I think one of the things, there's a couple of things I want to address in what you said. The first is, you know, I totally get what you're saying, like this idea of connecting with yourself. I think a lot of people have an apprehension, especially honestly, Christians, because we have a misunderstanding, in my opinion, my experience clinically, personally, just every way, we villainize the self.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we have to be curious about that, because we have to say that, you know, Paul talks about, don't think of yourself higher than you ought, but how ought we to think of ourselves? Like, Jesus calls us, you know, we're beloved. We're a royal priesthood. Our bodies are a temple. Like, man, that's a pretty good way to think about yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So if we can accurately recognize, like, we are so loved, man, if that's how I think of myself, I'll take it.
And you will treat yourself like, I know. Yeah, I do struggle with that. Absolutely. I'll admit that. And, but if you do what you're saying, like, actually, mm-hmm. think of yourselves those ways that the Bible does tell us to, it's going to cause you to act differently than if you think of yourself as kind of worthless or nothing.
Yeah. Well, so, cause here's where I think the neuroscience matters. What we know is that, like, in my clinical experience, what I see is that what you're describing, that worthlessness and those things, is that that's a stuckness. Right? Mm-hmm. That comes from, oftentimes those are really core beliefs. Maybe we've internalized often from those little T trauma or even big T trauma experiences where we've come to believe that's true. And so what is important is when we recognize that trauma needs to be able to process so that our full brain can be connected. And what that allows us to do is connect to this idea that even though this person maybe thinks I'm worthless, this is what God says about me, or this is what my spouse thinks about me, or this is how my best friend treats me. And that actually helps us integrate and not have that feeling. Mm-hmm. So what that, or maybe not get stuck there. So the reason that matters is that maybe we've experienced that briefly, but then we're able to actually turn back out towards our neighbor and be like, you know, I'm hurting, but I'm noticing, like, you're hurting. And, like, you matter too. And so there's this reciprocation that happens with each other. And so it's like, instead of us being stuck on ourselves, we're like, oh, I matter and you matter. Mm-hmm. We love our neighbor as ourselves, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I guess the reason why, because I know we're going off on a tangent from what we were talking about a couple minutes ago, but from a neuroscience perspective, one of the things that I think is helpful is that when we're in our window of tolerance, paying compassionate attention to ourselves, our full brain is online, meaning the top of our brain it's called our prefrontal cortex. And that's this part of our brain that it develops last, and it has the ability to think about thinking. And the reason why this matters, going back to this, what you said, like connecting with ourselves, in a way, that's really what I'm talking about. Like, it's like this part of our brain that can think about thinking can say, wow, when so-and-so said this to me and I got super defensive, that's really interesting that I had such a big reaction. Mm-hmm. And so it's like our brain begins to take almost like parent itself. It's sort of like how God parents us. We can say to ourselves, hey, I can see there's like something there that really hurts.
Yeah.
And I wonder who you could reach out to, or I wonder if there's something that might make you or might help you remember how important you are, or that person's opinion mm-hmm. is not the ultimate truth. And so I guess all that to say, like, we have, bringing it back to that big culture question, a lot of us, including our kids, are living from the lower parts of our brain.
Yeah.
And when we're living from that low part of our brain, the only goal is survival, quite literally. That's how those parts of our brain are wired, whether or not we're actually in dangerous situations. So, you know, whether we're talking in the church or the bigger culture, we have to recognize this shared humanity that we can't, like, we can't think ourselves out of this survival response. This is where gentleness matters. This is where getting reconnected to truly our body. You know, are you familiar with the term grounding? Have you ever heard that before?
Maybe not in the context that we're talking about. So probably just say no.
Okay, cool. Well, and as a side note, you know, for anybody who's listening, one of the things I do for people who sign up for my email list is I send out a video when you sign up, and it's to walk people through this coping skill called grounding. Mm-hmm. And grounding is a way that we just become so present in our current, like right now experience, using our senses to get back in our window of tolerance. So I personally use it all the time. I teach it to all my clients because like when we're nearing the edge of our window of tolerance, it's like trying harder doesn't necessarily help.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of like using our body, helping our body to get reintegrated so we mm-hmm. can stay in our window.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings us back to kind of that original question of why are Christians, why is it so hard for us to, what's our hang up with like, with kind of not segregating and separating and dividing us into kind of like a body and then a spirit and saying these two things, never the two shall meet, almost kind of like they're not connected. They're not related, which we know isn't true, but why does it seem like right now in Christian culture that is kind of just the, I don't know, or maybe it has been, and maybe that's changing, yeah. But seems like it has been that way for sure.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great insight. Yeah, one of the things that I talk about in the book is something I call functional Gnosticism. And Gnosticism is just basically, it's a heresy that was present in the really early church, that there was this belief that our spirits were more holy or better or cleaner or more pure than our flesh and our body. Mm-hmm. And this heresy ended up being sort of, you know, rejected, partly because it would mean that, you know, questioning that Jesus came in a body and lived in a human body and was born of Mary and all these really significant things that matter so much for us, even for just our humanity. And so my experience and what I observe is that, you know, a lot of us, we believe like our bodies are a temple, but we've been socialized and parented and just acculturated into a very Western culture that values logic and reason and facts over lived embodied experience. And so even though our faith really does point to a very holistic way to be as humans, I mean, it really does. Like I continually come back to really the significance of Jesus living, dying in a body. Like just the fact that he would take that on has so much meaning, even as we think about processing trauma, because it means that like he really lived that with us. Mm-hmm. Like God's not asking us like, ooh, you guys are gross and dirty, get away from me. He's like, no, 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 I'll come to you. Mm-hmm. I'll be with you. I'll put this on with you. And so I guess all that to say, I think a lot of it to be, I mean, I'm sure this is the bias of my work, but I think it's trauma. I think it's very much.
Full circle. Yeah.
Full circle that I think we've got a lot of, you know, what we know is that trauma gets passed down through epigenetics. We know
epigenetics.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Epigenetics is basically like a part of our DNA that it gets. So like if there was a study where Holocaust survivors, it showed that their children, some of their DNA was actually like there was like a mutation that occurred because of the trauma that those survivors, like that they carried in their body. So meaning the trauma we carry in our bodies can be transferred even when our kiddos aren't the ones to like in first person experience it.
Mm-hmm. And would you liken that? Is there any connection there with generational sin, or would you say that's different?
I think that there's certainly a crossover. Mm-hmm. But I always try to be careful not to just couch trauma in sin.
Yeah,
because it's so complex.
Not the same thing at all.
Not the same thing.
No.
But I think that there's certainly a crossover, and like it makes me wonder. I think that it's something I personally am curious about. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't feel like I have any firm answers on like this is exactly it, but I think it's really interesting and fascinating that the Bible shows that the significance of something just being passed down anyway, because I think that shows a level of wisdom for a book that's written so many years ago, to see that this is something now that science is actually proving how our mm-hmm. bodies change. So I guess all that to say, to answer that first question, I think a lot of it comes back to unaddressed trauma that keeps us from inhabiting and really living in our bodies.
Yeah, man, this is just such, it's so interesting. And it's like, I think a lot of what you're saying is applies to almost everyone listening. You know what I'm saying? Like the little t traumas, like, you know, we all have like those kind of early memories of like the first time somebody was mean to you, or the first time that you had a fight with your best friend, or the first time you remember your mom yelling at you, or finding your parents in a fight, or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is, that those little things, like, just, they can create almost like, I imagine it like a ripple effect kind of in us that we don't ever intend. It's not like any particular memory. It's just like these little faint whispers almost, in a sense. And like those form kind of what you believe or what you think or what you classify as good or bad or wrong or right. And then that kind of starts to color your perception of reality today as an adult. And it's just, yes. It's crazy how intersecting all of this is, you know, because you're studying it.
Well, totally. But I think what you're saying, and to hear you reflect it back, I think you're exactly right, which is really why I felt like I had to write this book. Because mm-hmm. even though I really do think, you know, the trauma I experienced was pretty significant, and yet mm-hmm. what I have found is that people who haven't experienced what anyone would necessarily put under significant trauma, I work with folks who they have this similar symptoms. And when we go back, we come to recognize it's all about the perception of the experience that colors how our body sort of encodes it. And so if our body perceived it as traumatic or disturbing, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter how many facts that we can spout out mm-hmm. about why it wasn't trauma, it may still be a form of little t trauma.
So give me an example of like what that would look like when you say something in your body that is like categorized that way.
Yeah. So, you know, because I think a lot of people, one of the things I find with a lot of clients is, you know, maybe they have a strong relationship with their parents in the present. And so they feel really bad about even considering that something that might have happened like in their story or childhood might have been wounding. Mm. And so I, a lot of times we'll talk about, it's not even necessarily about the intention of the parent. Like there's a lot of really loving, well-intentioned parents who sometimes, because of their own blind spots, weren't able to provide the repair that their kiddo needed. So I think a really common thing is when parents just really don't allow their kids to feel feelings, to be honest. Like, it's like anytime feelings come up, it's not okay.
Shove it down.
They don't have words for it. They don't know what to say about it. They might feel shame when they feel it. Mm-hmm. And so even though there's a lot of other good things going on, that particular thing may become something as an adult where anytime they have big feelings, maybe something like a big T trauma, like a car accident or, you know, a sexual violence or something like that does happen, when we don't have the capacity to feel our feelings, it's more likely for it to turn into like PTSD. Mm-hmm. So that's how those things begin to get connected in our body. And oftentimes we have to go back and actually do the work of processing those really early experiences so that we can actually process the present day experiences.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about why doing this work and why pursuing healing from any one of these experiences or little t traumas or big t traumas or whatever it may be that somebody's thinking, like, I have some stuff like that. Like, but why should I? And also the question of this being God honoring, because you say that as a therapist and a Christian, that you kind of give insight about healing from depression, anxiety, and stress in God-honoring and psychologically effective ways. And I think it's almost like it's a new way of thinking to unite those two instead of saying, well, if I want to honor God, I just kind of need to like overlook whatever these things are and just cling to the truth and like almost, you know, use the truth in place of healing to try and bandage over what, you know what I mean? Like yeah. you were saying earlier, like, this is true. Yeah. This is true. I know I'm a beloved daughter of God. I know that Jesus died for my sins. I know that he loves me. So all of those things that I might remember are just not true. And I'm not saying we shouldn't say or believe or do that, but there might be more needed beyond
absolutely
preaching
yeah.
the truth to yourself. And we talk about that a lot on the show, is like, preach the truth to yourself, preach the truth to yourself. I don't think that's, I'm not minimizing that in any way. And I don't think yeah. that's like, we're not throwing that out the window, but what about when we need more than simply speaking the truth to ourselves, and we do need to explore healing and pursue healing?
Yeah. So I think what you're asking is really a common question and almost a fear that people think that, well, if I do this, maybe I'm selfish, mm-hmm. or maybe it's too much about me, or maybe I'm focused, you know, this is a really common one. Like, don't think about painful things, because mm-hmm. there's so many people who are afraid of pain.
Yeah.
And so to
me included.
Yeah, no, I get it. And you know what? That's so human. So I don't want to shame or make anyone feel bad. Like, that's mm-hmm. really normal. Pain yeah. is hard, you know? Yeah. So this is, you know, this is where I would go with that, is to first of all talk about one of the ideas that I look at in the book a little bit, is this idea of like, what does Jesus mean by abundant life? And I've come to believe that Jesus is talking about wholeness. Jesus is talking about the fullness of what is available to us in God. And when we are sort of trying to talk ourselves into a truth that is true, but we can't embody it yet, I think that's a version of spiritual white knuckling it. It's like, yeah. and listen, if that's where you're at, it is what it is. There's, you know, Jesus is just like we started the podcast with, like, God is with us right now, mm-hmm. right now in the present. And so there's not like, there's no shame in that. But I think Jesus is really inviting us to this abundant life, which means it's more than just our top of our brain that knows facts, more than just a left brain. Jesus is inviting us into a whole person experience of him. And the way that we can do that is by allowing our body to heal from the pain and the trauma that is stuck there. And I firmly believe that God is the author of every good and perfect thing, including the ways our body was made to heal. Like, it is truly a gift that our bodies can heal. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the fact that this is literally how we're wired. And it's more like us stewarding the gift mm-hmm. that God has given us, rather than being like, oh, I'm going to do something that's like outside of God's
right.
will, you know?
Yeah. I'm dishonoring God by not, you know, just clinging to this truth. Like you said, the white knuckling, I mean, even the verbiage is kind of there for, mm-hmm. Which like we have to do. We do have to. Sometimes you feel like you're, you know, lies are pulling you away, and you do have to hold on to what you know is true and recognize that, like, just because I feel a certain way doesn't mean my feelings are true. You know, the feeling is not mm-hmm. get to control me. It doesn't get to be the boss of me and to tell me, you know, that because I have a feeling of doubt or whatever, that that's true. Well, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe God doesn't exist, or maybe God doesn't actually love you, or maybe he didn't actually forgive you, and he's going to hold you accountable for all of your sins, and Jesus's blood is not going to cover you. You know, all those things, that those doubts that can creep in. But I think it's so refreshing, the idea of not having to be like either or, you know, like I'm a very black and white thinker. So things that are gray are hard for me to grasp. I totally get black and white, but when it comes to, and I don't, you know, that's not the most helpful way to describe this, but almost like, it's not like, we're not saying you either abandon your body and what you're feeling, and you just go to your spiritual, you're like in your heart, like, Jesus, help me overcome this, you know, this disbelief, help my unbelief. And we're not saying that, you know, that has nothing to do with it, right? We're saying they're connected, they're integrated. You are one whole person that God made, yes. both body and soul.
Yep. Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And there's two things I would want to say. The first is that sometimes when we have like these really big feelings, it's actually one of the ways, a way to try softer with that is to actually just get curious with them. Instead of being like, fighting them to be able to say, huh, that's interesting that this big feeling is coming up. Because what's so cool is that we begin to, like, from a neuroscience perspective, from a physiological perspective, it helps us stay in our window of tolerance. Mm-hmm. And it helps us say, God is with me, and having this really big feeling of doubt. And sometimes we can get under that feeling and be like, well, you know, this thing happened that made me doubt that I belong at this group that really matters to me. And now it's making, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so this is the path, in a way, to wholeness, to being able to be like, to hold in one hand that God is so good and kind and loving and with us. And God made our emotions. Like, mm-hmm. our emotions are part of what it means to be human. So how do we work with them rather than against them? So anyways, I wanted to say that because I think so many times we're like at war with ourselves. Yeah. And it's like, if we can be gentle and be like, wow, God, this is real hard.
Yeah.
Like, this is really hard. It's okay to name that. But then can we be gentle with that? I think it can be a really powerful way through.
Yeah, seriously. Man, there's just so much here that we could talk about. And obviously people need to read your book. So give us a little more details on all of that and where we can stay connected with you.
Yes. Okay. So you can pre-order or order if it's when it comes out at Amazon and Barnes and Noble, at Tyndale, and at, I forget, it's the Christian, there's another Christian one that I'm forgetting.
Okay.
And then, you know, at my website, andycolbert.com, and I'd love for you to sign up for my email list. Like I said, I have the free video that comes with it, and I'm hoping to do some more sort of supportive videos to kind of help people through this experiential aspect of what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's so cool. Man, thank you so much for sharing everything that you did today and just being, you know, using your own story to help so many others, because I know, you know, you're not the only one. And I think what you have kind of undergone, like you described over the last decade, is going to help a lot of people understand their own stories better too. So I really appreciate everything that you are doing.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
Thank you guys so much for joining us today. I hope you'll come back next week. I have a really exciting mini series launching, and it is all about education. We don't always do this on Kindled. Usually this is a week-to-week topical conversation, but this is going to be a mini series that's going to cover several weeks, where I'm going to be chatting with women who have chosen everything from homeschool to private school to public school as their route of educating their families, their children. And you're going to get to hear our conversations. I've asked them questions of how they have come to make those decisions, what considerations they had, what fears they had, what lies they believed, and ultimately how God has been faithful to them and their families through those choices, regardless of what they've chosen. So it's going to be a really interesting, and I hope and pray, encouraging and uplifting mini series for you. So definitely come back next week and join us for that. Until then, come say hi to me on Instagram, my platform of choice, where we can chat and I will share the behind the scenes of my everyday life. Not that it's super interesting. Also things like when I make cupcakes, and then also buy a program to help me heal my core and abdominal diastasis, whatever that ab separation thing is after pregnancy, because that is my life and that's who I really am. So I'll see you over there on Instagram at HaleyWilliams.Kindled. And until then, have a great week, guys. Bye.